Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. The history of the United States was founded in agriculture. In 1790, a year after the adoption of the Constitution, 95% of our 4 million people, including almost all of America's 700,000 slaves, lived and worked on farms. Today, less than 2% do. Yet farming and ranching remain major components of our economy and our culture. In Montana in 2010, we still had 29,000 farms averaging 2,000 acres. And the chances are extremely high that the food you ate this morning for breakfast came from a farm. In short, agriculture represents both change and continuity. John Youngberg knows something about that. Now their executive vice president. He's worked for the Montana Farm Bureau Federation for 24 years. John, it's good to have you back on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here.
It's been a while. I can't remember where you grew up and what your folks did.
I came from Clyde Park, Montana. I didn't get too far from home. My mom was a school teacher at Clyde Park. She never got past kindergarten, but she taught school there for close to 30 years. My dad worked for the county. He was a road grader operator. We had a little 20, 30 acres where we ran a few sheep, and that's where I grew up. That's how I started in agriculture. But he was the road foreman for the county in Park County for a number of years. So kind of a blue-collar thing. I always tell people I went to a real small school. I was second in my class and wasn't in the top 10%. So.
Now, with that rural background, you could have gone a lot of different directions. What's your educational background?
Went to MSU for a couple of years and then dropped out, got married and had a bunch of kids. So
What's a bunch?
Three.
You could have gone into different careers. You said the sheep sort of might influence your choice of agriculture. What captivated you about agriculture?
I think a lot of it is the people that you get exposed to that you deal with. I think that's what I really appreciated about it then, the people I grew up with and the people that I meet in Farm Bureau now. I mean, we've got members who have been in agriculture for their families for hundreds of years. We got people that just moved here that just got started or are trying to get started. So there's a lot of different stories in those people in agriculture, and every one of them is a good story, and there's a lot of really good people.
If you were to describe what really good people means, what are you talking about specifically in relation to agriculture?
Well, I think traditionally are conservative people. They're hardworking people. You know, they're willing to do their part and maybe a little bit more. Those are good people.
When you say conservative, did you just define it by those terms you added afterwards, willing to do their part and maybe a little bit more, or is there more to being conservative in the agricultural sense of the word?
Well, I think agricultural people are conservative by nature. They learn to use things more than once. They take what they do very seriously. You've got to be conservative if you keep spending more money than you have or are using more than what you have, whether it's a resource or whether it's money, you're soon going to be out. So they learn to conserve that resource or that money.
In other words, they don't like wasting things as part of their ethic. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair assumption, yes.
Anything else?
Probably practicality is an overarching thing in agriculture. I mean, we try to do things that are practical. If you look for a means to an end, that's the most practical way of getting it done. And those are the good people that can do that.
I don't know that we've had a chance to discuss this, but I go back a fair ways to my childhood with agricultural people. And in addition to the qualities you talk about, I would add a directness.
Yes, that's another really good description of people for the most part. I think the people in agriculture, and I think you find that generally in Montana too. People that, you know, they're going to tell you where the bear spit and the buckwheat. I mean, it's going to be, they'll tell you where it's at.
In my introduction, I said you'd been with the Farm Bureau for literally a quarter century. What holds a guy's interest that long for any organization?
A couple of things. Number one, I mentioned the people that I work with, and not only the members that we have, but our boards of directors over the years, they're good people. The staff that I've had to work with over the years has been good. And I think another thing is the the background, the depth of Farm Bureau. It's not only the Montana Farm Bureau. It's the County Farm Bureau that comes up with ideas. It's the State Farm Bureau. It's the American Farm Bureau that's provides us with information on issues. And I got to tell you, I'm a little bit of a political junkie. You don't lobby for as long as I have without being that. And so I love the issues, and I love the people that we work with.
Let's talk about elements of that. How many members in Montana?
About 22,000 members in Montana.
Okay, my understanding is you don't have to be a farmer to be a member of the Farm Bureau, correct?
Correct. You can. We have associate members and agricultural members.
With the difference being?
The agricultural members have to make a portion of their income from agriculture. So in order to be a voting member or a regular member of Farm Bureau, you have to be involved. A portion of your income has to come from agriculture. Now, that could be whether you're directly involved in production agriculture, or maybe you're involved in, an ancillary business with agriculture.
If I was a wholesaler of potatoes, I would qualify?
You could. It would be up to the county that you were in to make that determination of whether you were in agriculture.
Okay, and the basic breakdown in terms of associate members not in agriculture of the 22,000 versus those that are is what?
The majority of them are associate members.
Why would that be? That would surprise somebody.
Because first off, we only have about 23,000 agriculturalists in Montana. We have about 6,000 members that are farm and ranch people. We also, in 1952, our members found it extremely hard to buy insurance, so we started our own insurance company. And you can buy insurance, Farm Bureau insurance, if you're not involved in agriculture, and that has become a big part of our membership, is those people that they get a discount on their insurance if they're a member of Farm Bureau. So a lot of those folks join Farm Bureau in order to maintain a discount on their insurance.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with John Youngberg, Executive Vice President of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation. Now, I think I heard you say only farming members or full members got to influence policy decisions.
That is true, and we are an agricultural organization. We represent farmers and ranchers, so it wouldn't be an agricultural organization if we allowed people in the city to make those decisions. So we allow the people to make decisions on agriculture policy that are directly involved in agriculture.
I have a couple of friends in Farm Bureau, and they have told me, and I have regarded with skepticism, that it's actually the members rather than staff that make policy decisions on important issues by a series of meetings at the county level and then et cetera, et cetera. Now, are they feed me a line or is this the way it works?
Yeah, that's the way it works. And we're one of the few organizations, I think, that are strictly a grassroots organization. Our membership or our policy comes from our membership. It starts at the county level. And I think the best example I could give is a policy that came into our books a few years ago. Started in Broadwater County. A rancher came to his first meeting and he said, I grow hay that's I consider to be premium hay, but my neighbor down the road has hay that is not as good, but he says it's premium as well. So there should be a means of judging what's premium hay. There should be a standard. The county thought that was a good idea. So at their county meeting, they voted to place that in the county policy book.
Now, let me just jump in. When you say the county, we're not talking about county government. We're talking about the county division of the Farm Bureau.
Exactly. There's no county government. Okay. We're non-governmental. So the County Farm Bureau said, that sounds like a good idea. The farmers and ranchers thought that was a good idea. So they passed it on to the state convention. At the state convention, the delegates from each county in the state looked at that policy and thought that was a good idea, and they voted it to be in the Montana Farm Bureau policy book. They passed it on to the American Farm Bureau, and at that meeting where every state's represented, plus Puerto Rico, they have representatives from all the states, they looked at it and said, that is a good idea. We should have some means of judging that commodity and to make a standard for that. And today, something that was Chuck Hahn's idea in Broadwater County in Townsend, Montana, is now in the American Farm Bureau policy book.
Homeground's done programs in Cuba, and I was surprised to learn that the Farm Bureau, I think nationally, but you could tell me also if it's a Montana policy, favors change in our economic policy relative to Cuba. Is that true? And if so, where did it come from?
That is true, and we've supported increasing trade with Cuba for a number of years. We grow enough commodity in the United States to feed a lot of people, in essence, feed the world. A big portion of our income has to come from trade. We have a trading partner that's 93 miles from our shore that we have limited trade with. We'd like to see that open it up. They can use the commodities that we provide for them. They're willing to pay for those. If we have the ability to trade with them, we should be allowed to trade.
Now, in reading the resume you supplied for this show, I was quite astonished to see that you'd served on the Belgrade City Council for the last 25 years and the Belgrade City County Planning Board. You're a busy guy. Why would you serve for 25 years on both those or either one of those boards?
Well, I actually got on the city council in Belgrade because we had a bunch of streets that weren't paved, and that was my goal. I was going to get the streets paved in Belgrade. That happened, and then something else came along, and then something else, and I guess if nobody complained about my work, they kept electing me, so I was on there. And it's been interesting because Belgrade's been one of the fastest-growing cities in Montana over the past couple decades. So,
what does that mean about how many people in the city? I've lost track.
Well, when I started on the city council or when we moved to Belgrade, there was about 3,500 people in town. Right now, we're about 8,000 people in town. But the interesting thing is our school district, which the Belgrade School District encompasses almost 18,000 people. So there's a lot of growth around Belgrade that affects Belgrade there in the Gallatin Valley. And so we've had some struggles in keeping up with that.
Raises a very interesting issue. I was a county supervisor in California in the 70s, which is a county commissioner in Montana. It was a full-time job, and the county was 40 by 50 square miles, so 2,000 square miles, seven cities. We controlled land use planning in the non-city areas, which was the vast majority of acreage in the county. The idea of land use planning was accepted, I would say, by 90% of the people in cities. But when you went out into the county and you had agricultural people, they were very skeptical of the idea of putting limitations, one house per 60 acres or 100 acres or whatever it would be. What's your experience, first of all, with the Farm Bureau membership's idea toward land use planning?
It's interesting. Our policy on land use planning is that as people are migrating out of the cities a little bit more to a more rural setting, that they should be involved in land use planning. That's not to say there hasn't been some interesting times for me in Belgrade. Farm Bureau is a big believer in private property rights.
Right.
And so when you have somebody has the right to use their property as they will, but yet if you're within a mile of the city limits, the city has the ability to zone that property. And if you're within 4 miles of the city limits, the city has the ability to plan in that donut area. So there's been a few rubs over the years with how you maintain that property right for people, but you continue to plan for the growth of the city.
It's a very interesting basic philosophical question because the word property rights is very prominent in the political spectrum, as you know, as a lobbyist, and it's a simple phrase. There is a basic philosophical divide or difference, and I'd like to get your perspective on it. One is property rights are total. I can do what I want with my property, period. Another one says I have substantial property rights to do what I want, but the community has also the right to protect its interests through some kind of planning, infringing, quote-unquote, on unlimited property rights. Where do you come down as a city commissioner?
I think the answer to that lies in, yes, you have property rights, but your neighbor also has property rights. And you can't do anything on your property that would affect your neighbor's property. And that's where the planning comes in, is how we balance those property rights. Your neighbor's ability to build houses on his, your ability to do agriculture on yours. I think where we ended up a lot of times in the Gallatin Valley in particular is that agricultural neighbor, the truth is his retirement program is probably his ability to subdivide his property. So he wants to retain his ability to utilize his property as it is now, but down the road, it may become untenable for him to farm that property because of surrounding. So he wants the ability, and that's probably, for a lot of those folks, that's their retirement policy.
Okay, and having lived in that seat exactly, facing that question 35 years ago, the young farmers would say, if you allow a subdivision on the neighbor's place, you're going to put me out of business. We need some protection. We need some limits on the density. For example, instead of saying one house per acre, which the guy's going to say, the dairyman's going to say, if that happens, they're going to drive me out of business. They won't want the smell. They would say, let's have some compromise where there's limits on the number of houses per acre, and maybe they're clustered in one part of the property. Now, when you hear those kind of discussions, and you must have heard those kind of discussions, how do you balance the rights and the rights of the neighbor, and also does the community have rights?
The key word that you said is balance those rights. And, you know, there's got to be some compromise in that. And we, we're going to stand for the guy that's in agriculture, and we're going to try and protect him in Farm Bureau. But as a city councilman, I have to look at the future of a growing city. And so we end up trying to balance that. And you can do that. There's a number of ways to do that. If you're in a zoning situation, you can put different zoning on. You can have ag suburban. You can have, and that limits the amount, the density, as you said. So it's a balancing act all the way. And we've been fairly successful. I'm not saying that everybody's always been 100% happy on either side of the issue, but maybe that means we're doing it close to right.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with John Youngberg, Executive Vice President of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation and member of the Belgrade City Council. Now, in addition to your what I will call political community experience on the Belgrade City Council, you're a lobbyist for the Farm Bureau in the state legislature. Fair?
Fair.
Over what period of time?
I started to do membership relations for Farm Bureau, and I'd only been there a couple months, and there was a special session, and our regular lobbyist was actually placed in a state bowling tournament and had signed up to go to the national bowling tournament. So they hosed me off and carried me below the knees and sent me to Helena to lobby for Farm Bureau.
So how did you find it walking in?
I think that, first off, I loved it. I was scared to death, as always would be. But I think I learned the most important lesson I ever learned in lobbying that first time. I was taken into the by a group of people that told me what I should be talking about and explained to me how it was to go. And I got up there, and the most important lesson I learned in lobbying, I learned from Representative Jerry Driscoll. It was then Representative Jerry Driscoll.
Democrat, correct?
Yep. Jerry, it was about something to do with mining. And those people can sense fear, and they can sense weakness. And so the biggest lesson I learned, if you don't know what you're talking about, give your testimony and leave the room, because they're going to ask you questions.
Well, I'm glad to hear they ask questions. Let me ask you this. You've been at it a long time. We have a part-time legislature. I've had experience with both full-time paid legislators that work year-round like we have in Congress. That was the case in California in the 70s when I was there, and part-time. One school of thought is full-time politicians become corrupted and isolated from the people. Another is they've got the time to get around and learn and talk with different constituencies and learn something of their realities. That school holds that the part-time legislators, with the best of intentions, are in there for a very short period of time and really can't learn the other diversity of the community's stories and important facts of life. What's your experience about the depth of knowledge of the folks you lobby in the Montana legislature, and has it changed over time of the 20-some years you've been at this?
Yes, it has changed. An example of that is We have between 1,500 and 2,500 bills in any given session. And they run the gamut from social issues to agricultural issues to wildlife issues to labor issues to insurance issues. I mean, it's a very broad spectrum. There is nobody that's an expert in all those things.
All right.
And so they learn through experience about, you know, about those issues, or they have to learn it from somebody. I think the worst thing we've done in Montana is term limits, quite truthfully. Term limits have taken away the ability of those people to be there for a lot of years and understand those issues and to build relationships with other legislators. Now we turn over a new bunch every couple of years. The education of those people has to be done by somebody. It's either going to be done by a lobbyist or it's going to be done by somebody in state government. And so, because not there is nobody that has a broad knowledge of every issue that comes before them in the legislature. So I think we're, my opinion, term limits has not helped us in creating good law in Montana.
It's an interesting observation to hear you say that, because you said knowledge of diverse subjects and relationships, and the inference was both are critical to being a good legislator.
Absolutely. Politics is not black and white. Politics is the art of compromise. It's the art of talking to other people, getting what you need while giving them something they need. There was a time when you would see legislators from either party argue, debate an issue over and over. And I think probably the best example of that I can think of is a number of years ago, the sales tax came up. And J.D. Lynch was on one side, and I can't remember, Bruce Crippen was arguing for, J.D. Lynch was arguing against. The galley in the Senate was full. They actually got a standing ovation at the end of that that debate on the sales tax. Those two guys walked out of the chambers arm in arm and went downtown to have dinner together. They had built relationships. What they were dealing with was their side of it. It was not a personal issue. I think with term limits, nobody has developed a relationship with people on the other side of the aisle. A lot of times haven't developed relationships with people on their own side of the aisle. So there's none of that. Everything's personal when you don't have a relationship with them.
Very interesting. I think the most important thing I learned as a young county supervisor was what I didn't know, how much I didn't know. I had very strong opinions about any issue you want to raise. I've thought about it. And I had an experience, which I don't have time to go into. I'd looked at a kid on a bicycle is what it boiled down to going to work one day, and I thought, my God, I represent that kid, and my vote affects his life. I better know what I'm talking about. And the only way I got to know what I was talking about was to ask a lot of questions of people who had different ideas and experiences than mine. And hopefully because of that, I cast my votes carefully with some thought. So I'm hearing you say that the term limits prevent the relationships, the sharing of knowledge, the working things through, to some extent.
I think it does. And again, you don't have the ability to know a lot about the people that you're working with. And so it's hard to come to any consensus with people. And again, it becomes personal. You get a lot of people that come in and they're single issue driven. They got elected on a single issue. They don't have a lot of depth of knowledge of other issues, nor do some of them have a lot of concern about other issues.
The inference of this to me is, if what you say is the case, and if the legislature does important business, it's not doing it as well as if we didn't have term limits. Would you go that far?
I think the legislature makes pretty good decisions. It's kind of like making sausage. You don't want to see what goes into the sausage at the end. And I think we come out with some good outcomes. But I think at times we get bogged down in a lot of minutiae that we wouldn't have to. Because of term limits. I think that we're not as effective as we could be.
During my 25 years here, I've seen a lot of polarization, I would say, in positions between the environmental community and elements of the ag community. Yet there was recently a process where people tried to come up with some common ground on the sage-grouse issue. Were you guys involved in that issue?
Yes, we were, although we weren't on the committee that came up with the ultimate plan for for the sage grouse, we were involved with that. We attended the meetings. We had input to the meetings, and I think it's what it comes down to is there's an outcome that nobody really particularly wanted, and that was listing the sage grouse. And,
listing under the Endangered Species Act by the federal government.
Right. So agriculture didn't want that. I don't think the environmental community particularly wanted that. So we had to come up with a way that was acceptable to both sides of the issue that we could keep them from being listed. And again, you know, we aren't entirely happy with that. I know the oil and gas people are not as entirely happy. I think it's something that both sides can live with. And there again, it's the art of compromise.
Let's talk about that. Each of those entities, environmental, agriculture, and energy, let's just say that roughly speaking, had a position. And their position would be, if I was to summarize it, I want everything that I can get if I'm a sage-grouse advocate for the best habitat protection for sage-grouse. If I'm an energy guy, I want to say, hey, I owe my shareholders maximum return on investment. Ag, I say ag production's tough, another burden on me imposed by the federal government, I'm not interested. How does the process work where they can come up with something, what you just said, everybody can live with? They didn't get everything they wanted.
I wish I had a perfect answer for that, because we could use that a lot in a lot of instances, but I don't think there's a perfect answer. I think the answer is it's you grind through a lot of those things. You talk about, first off, you start with what you have in common, what you want to see happen, and then you start to weed out those things that you don't have in common. You kind of lay those aside and try to come up with solutions on the things you have in common. And a lot of times it works into some of those things that are the outliers that you don't have in common, that you can't agree on, but it drags some of those in when you start working on the things you do have in common.
For that to work, in my experience, and I've done a fair amount of environmental economic facilitation between interests, you got to have people at the table that can listen to the other guy. They're not going to assume the other person's right, but you got to be able to listen and say, well, I can live with that, or like that makes sense, et cetera. Is that your experience, that personality matters in that kind of dialogue?
Absolutely. If you have somebody that's an ideologue that has no ability to change their mind, you know, you're not going to get anywhere on that.
If I was to ask you about the Farm Bureau, which represents about one quarter of the agricultural people in the state, as an organization, you represent your people. You've said they have a serious influence in policy. How do you characterize the Farm Bureau on this basic question? Are you the kind of organization that can sit down and work together and see if there's a common ground, or is it more I'm representing my way or the highway?
I think we strive to be the people that can sit down at the table. I think we have members who have a different opinion, but my opinion is if you're not at the table, you're on the table, and we have to try to be at the table.
John Youngberg, I very much regret to say we're out of time. Great to see you again. I want to thank you so much for being on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. We'll